This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Wavelength now repeats twice on Mondays at 3 a.m. and 3 p.m. Today's guests are Nicholas de Oliveira from the SE8 Gallery in Deptford, South London, and two artists whose show opens this evening, Friday the 29th of September, at the aforementioned SE8 Gallery. The artists in question are Paul Good and Kirsty Wood, and the new work is called Stale Air in a Room Before Motion. The private view tonight will feature a live sound performance by the artists and coincides with the launch of a vinyl catalogue featuring a soundtrack from the exhibition and a text by the curators. Before we go into that, I received an email, Nico, from I'm not sure where, which said, we are pleased to announce the appointment of Nicholas de Oliveira as director of the Foundation Art Institutions of the 21st Century.
Ah, how interesting. Yes, this is one of my several hats that I wear, and it's something that I'm very committed to. And it is a foundation that specifically looks at how institutions can work together better. And in fact, next Friday, we have our first proper annual meeting with all the worthy guests invited. So that's all very exciting, at which point we will be outlining the policy for the next year and presenting the new report, which is a report on artists' estates that's just been published.
When you say artists' estates, you mean what they leave behind, is it not?
Exactly. Uh-huh. It's the legacy of the artists, but not only, as people often assume, the idea of an archive, because that is obvious, but much more the legacy, that is to say, the strategy of how to actually cope with posthumous work. Mm. Posthumous work both in terms of the physical artifacts, or these could be installations or video works and so on and so forth, but also the wherewithal to actually maintain something like this. And this has become a big, big concern all across the world. And indeed, a lot of commercial galleries are becoming very, very involved in this because traditionally they look after the affairs of living artists, and they are indeed becoming very concerned with what happens to the work posthumously, because clearly it will not be the provide of museums to do this. They will simply not have the space or the public money for that, but I think it's going to be the private sector.
All right. Okay, really? Right. So you are the director of this institution. Does it exist as a building, or is this some sort of, is it only in the ether?
No, it exists as a building, for sure. It's always good to have a headquarters.
Mm-hmm. Where is it?
It's in Shoreditch.
Oh.
So I think that it's always good to have an abode. And,
yeah.
I would say that for a gallery, I would say that for an office, I would say that for a school or an institution of any sort. Of course, granted, there are many institutions that exist, as you quite correctly say, in the ether. But in this instance, I think it's good to have places to meet people, to meet real people.
Okay.
And I think this is what this is about. It's about meeting real people, yes, having a degree of mobility, but also having something you call home.
Right. Okay, and speaking of real people, we have two real people in the studio today, Paul Good and Kirsty Wood. Hi there. Well, thank you both for coming in. And you are going to exhibit with Nico's gallery, the SE8 gallery. Nico, the gallery has a specific kind of mission statement, doesn't it? Like the kind of artists that you take on. Remind me again, you have been a guest on this show before, but
yes.
I think there is something about it doesn't hang on the wall or something. There's something particular.
We're definitely more installation-based, which is what we are, and I think that's why it seemed like the perfect fit for us, actually.
Right.
As a place to do a show.
Okay. But it's not just installation art, is it, that you do? I mean, isn't there something more defined about it?
Well, I think for us, artworks come in the shape of projects. And projects tend to, I mean, when I say shape, I mean, sometimes they're quite formless, sometimes they're very formal. But what's obvious within this is that installation art was one of the touchstones. This is also connected to performance, performativity, and particularly sound art.
Right.
So working with Kirsty and Paul follows in a lineage of working with artists who have an interest in sound in particular, but also, for example, in areas of writing, spatiality, and so on and so forth. In other words, the kinds of things that are not necessarily traditionally part of the canon of art.
Okay. And okay, so how did you meet Paul and Kirsty? What's the story?
Well, Nikki were our tutors at university,
uh-huh.
which is also where me and Kirsty met.
Which university was that?
London Met.
London
which
Met.
I think it's now called the CAS.
Yeah.
Right.
But to us, it's London Met. That's where we went. And that's where me and Kirsty met.
Okay.
Where we started to collaborate.
Right. And you are a musical duo performing as Less, I think.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
You have one album out and one single, which is presumably being launched tonight.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And that was your opening track. That one was called Nothing Here Loop.
Well, that's actually when we first, something from that we used to do about 7 years ago. It's actually sort of, I like the idea of this, like an echo of something, what we used to do. And it'll contrast quite a lot with what we're going to play later on that's
right.
much fuller and bigger. And
yeah.
I sort of like the idea of like a contrast. That
it's kind of like the beginnings of what we, how we collaborated musically.
Uh-huh.
Which was so basic and simple, which is kind of funny, what we're doing now, which is so big and full and...
Right.
It's not basic and simple.
So even the idea of being called Less now is kind of...
Is more.
It's more.
Yeah,
it's
true.
The most funny that we're still... No, but
right.
still like the idea.
Okay. But did you start... You say you were art students?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you were playing music as art? Or was that like a side sort of issue
I think
to
it was a side project in the beginning.
You played the guitar and used to do open mics and you just wanted someone to sing. And so that's just how we began. You asked me to sing, and then I did, and then that's how we began to collaborate with music.
Right. But what was the ambition at the time to... I mean, do you see what I'm getting at? I mean, were you artists who had an artistic practice and then you thought we'll do music on the side? Or,
yeah,
or were you making music as part of the art?
I think... I think we would say our main practice is sculpture and installation.
Right.
And the music, I think, originally was a bit of a side project, but I think as the years have gone on, it's sort of become more part of it. And it's become more of this as the practice as a whole. And
right.
I think, especially in the last few years, we really got into it, and that's why we made an album. And And now it is sort of really part of our practice, and we're really...
Right. But do you, I mean, maybe you don't see any need to define it. Perhaps it can be left somewhere in the middle. I mean, I feel like, does it matter? Is the
It doesn't matter. I feel like people do define it. I think why this show's good is because we're sort of intentionally trying to show everything that we've been doing. And that's why we're including the recorded music and we're playing live and we've made an installation. And
To us,
it's all very connected, but I think to most people it might seem quite separate.
Okay.
And this show is definitely a conscious effort of...
Well, it's finally bringing these elements together visually and audioly.
Right.
And to show the links to people that maybe wouldn't...
What do you play? What do you do musically?
Well, I play the drums and do the singing, and you're the guitar.
Right.
The guitar.
Yeah, a guitar. Okay. Yeah. And I think you mentioned, you did mention before the show that you were sort of, were you influenced by Martin Creed, or is he just somebody you liked?
I think with the older music, like you heard of that, it was very repetitive and simple. And he makes this very process-based music.
Right.
So I think early on, that was an influence of a way into making music.
Yeah.
I think now I wouldn't say so much, but certainly in the past.
Right. Okay.
Well, it's sort of our way into how we wanted to build a sound, because we didn't have, neither of us had a background in actually, well, I speak for myself, being able to actually play an instrument.
Ah, right. Okay. That's interesting.
Paul was a lot better with the guitar, because he'd played it since being a teenager.
Yeah.
And I just thought a drum would be a really interesting instrument to play.
So as artists, you presumably sort of felt the confidence to be able to just play the drums without worrying too much about whether you
being,
were...
Being a student in art school, it's a bit more of a safer place, isn't it, to do to do that, or I felt like it was at the time.
Yeah.
But also I think using it to your advantage, we that's why what we used to do was so reduced, because it had to be. It was like make that the point, make that part of it, rather than fighting it and trying to fill out the sound with one drum kit and a guitar and no effects and pedals, and that's all we had, so we'd use that to our advantage and make it ultra minimal.
And I think there's something really interesting that you've highlighted, William, about this question of not worrying about something, and I think this is deeply ingrained in art schools, that often the hallmark of art bands, be the individual's proficient musically or not, that's not the issue. I think the issue is to make something new, to be daring, and not to worry too much about what comes out of it. And I recall very clearly throughout the years of SE8 and the spaces that we ran before, we always had a number of bands that came directly out of art schools. And I remember at one stage, we had a fabulous performance, which nobody could believe, by a group called The Hormones. And there were four young women dressed entirely in plastic bags who couldn't play the instruments. But they were fantastic. They were just so good. And and everybody was just totally just overwhelmed by how good this stuff was. And it came out of an art school attitude, this ability not to care and to do. And then you contrast that with the much more kind of sonically savvy people like ECM2 that we worked with in the past, who would arrive with an enormous amount of kit and things that you wouldn't understand what they actually meant, what they were. They were real kind of techies, wonderful people to work with, super knowledgeable, but they functioned like scientists.
Right, right.
And they made something which was clearly a soundscape in the space, but it kind of sounded like a rock concert.
Right. Do you aspire to that, do you think? What's your aspiration as musicians, if you call yourself musicians?
I think it feels quite new. We only made the album last year.
Right.
So I think we're still slightly figuring out
how it feels like we're still trying to define that, I think, really.
And we're just really enjoying making music, because we're already halfway through making another album.
Ah.
I think we're just going with the process.
What's the first album called?
We Are Using Your Language to Communicate.
Right. Okay. Do you wish to expand on that, or is it just a completely
Probably the idea that we always felt like we're not really a band, and it was this idea of we're using your language, using the language of music to say something, which is what you're doing with any art form, I guess. You're communicating.
Should we play a track, do you think, from, if I can figure this out. Choice, any particular? We've got 1, 2, 3, 4. Maybe. Six tracks, is that right?
Yeah.
What was the first one? The first one was you repeating one statement over
nothing
and over again.
Nothing here, nothing. That was the very intro one.
Exactly.
Played.
Nothing here loop. So what should we play?
B-side, Ancient of Days.
Ancient of Days.
Which is the B-side from the new record.
Okay. So that's called Ancient of Days. That's off the album.
Off the new record that accompanies the show that opens tonight.
Oh, right. So that's not the. So you've made one previous album or not?
Yeah, a separate album we made last year.
Oh, okay. So this is off the new album. Yeah. So, okay. Right. Yeah. Right. And there is a vinyl single as well, which is what, tracks from the same album or?
No, these are two new tracks. Okay. On the new 7-inch.
Yeah.
And there's an album we released last year, which is about 7 tracks.
Right. Okay. All right. And these products, are they placed anywhere, or do they only exist sort of, you know, are they limited editions sold in a gallery?
No, the album is digital. It's online.
Okay.
And the record is just an edition.
Right.
For the show of 300.
A 300.
Yeah.
And you can stream our album for free.
Right.
If you go to soundless.world.
You go to where?
Soundless.world.
Soundless.world. Okay. Less. Again.
Less, yeah.
And you can stream it for free.
Okay. There's a statement here. I mean, I've got various printed texts here, and this is one of your, I presume, one of your statements. We make songs like you would a sketch, sometimes starting with a basic structure and slowing building or editing until something forms that feels complete. So the composition becomes an organic process of experimenting and also balance. There is always a melancholic tone to the music we make, which is the hardest tone to make. You are trying to find a midpoint between a happy tone and a sad one. This gives the music an otherworldly feel. It's always in between. It can't be placed. It is never fixed. Nico.
Well, I think that's a statement specifically from the artists themselves.
Right.
And it's their way of thinking about process. I think that the process here is one which is obviously a temporal one. It takes time to make something like this, but I think it's also a spatial one in that they keep talking about the idea of sculpture.
Uh-huh.
That is to say, sound as a form of sculpture. There's an interesting discussion with Joseph Beuys, of all people, who argues that a sculpture in a space already has its own sonic imprint, as it were. That is to say, as you enter into a space, a sculpture is a volume and has an effect on the sonic perception of that space. So a lot of the discussions that we've been having around this question of sculpture is very much feeding into this kind of discussion that they started around this idea of music being sculptural.
Mm.
So it's somewhere between a space
right.
and the process.
When I looked at your website, I noticed some intriguing-looking sculptures, which are they crash symbols?
They are, yeah.
So you've created like an array, like replicas of crash symbols made out of what, plaster?
Yeah, they were all cast out of my symbol from my drum kit,
right.
And yeah, they were made out of jesmonite.
What's that?
Which is, it's like a resin and plaster
okay.
mix. It's just a bit stronger than plaster.
So then how many have you set up in this?
I think there's about 40 of them.
40?
Yeah, so we had a real process.
Gosh,
24-hour
okay.
production of
so
that.
So they're facsimiles, they're yeah. actual size
yes.
replicas.
Yeah, they are.
Of crash cymbals yep. made out of this brittle, fragile material,
yes.
which presumably from the picture, it looks like they've all been hit with something.
Yeah, so we almost smashed a pathway through them, so they kind of
right.
had a kind of a domino effect.
It's sort of like a remnant of a performance, I think we would say.
Yeah, that was
so the
idea.
So the idea that you can feel that something had just moved through it. It felt
yeah.
quite active.
Was it an actual performance, or is it, as you say, a remnant of a...
It was a performance, us making it, but I think what you see is the remnant. You see the...
Well, the actual smashing was like a private moment, wasn't it? We did it alone before anyone
right.
else viewed it. So it was the idea that you just missed something.
So there wasn't a public performance
no,
as
no,
such of
no,
smashing.
No, you just saw the remains of something that had happened before.
Right, so then you're left with this image of these white... quite sort of ghostly sort of instruments,
yeah.
which are in pieces, basically,
yes.
with the bits and fragments of the cymbals all over the floor.
Yeah, it looks very skeletal.
Yes.
Yeah.
It looks like a sort of carcass or something, you know.
Right.
It's quite a strange look to it. But
yeah.
Does this tap into sort of auto-destructive art and so on in some way? Or
perhaps on my part. I do have a a love of breaking things, and that's probably all thanks to Christoph Metzger.
I think
it really was the idea of a moment in time that it had just happened, and you seemed to just come in after the event had happened, like a score, I guess, like reading music.
Also, I feel like when we made it, it was when we set up the show, we had all these, we were kind of surrounded by all these symbols. And they were nice objects. I mean, they're very, like, technically to make those is very difficult.
Mm.
And to make so many. And they were, like, nice objects, but it wasn't majorly exciting. It was actually when we started breaking them that suddenly this energy sort of went into it.
Became activated.
Right. Was it a long process to make them?
Yeah, a few months. Yeah, that's non-stop.
A few months.
Yeah,
because the mould is a three-part mould at the bottom that goes into a two-part mould.
Right.
Yeah, it's quite a complicated thing.
Yeah. And leaking.
To get a tripod out of a mold.
So breaking them must have been was it difficult to smash up these things?
No, it was actually quite exciting.
I think I really enjoyed it, actually. It had been those months and months of, like, because I am naturally more clumsy and Paul's very, not clumsy. Uh-huh. And I felt like a real relief, actually, to take away that preciousness of them.
Right. Okay. It's interesting. You said, do you have any desire to smash things up as part of your musical performance? You know, obviously, the Who is an obvious example.
Of our installation is a new sculpture that's made from broken and fractured pieces of resin. So we have kind of continued it on, I guess you could say.
Right.
Which wasn't necessarily our intention. It wasn't sort of, but somehow we have managed to make another show of. Broken stuff.
Right. Because Metzger apparently did have an influence on The Who, didn't he?
And
they used to smash up Pete their instrument, smash the whole thing up on them. Yeah. And then there was, I think The Move used to smash up TVs also around about the same time.
Yeah, I suppose there's a whole history of bands smashing up stuff, isn't
there? Yeah, but sort of as part of, what do we call it, displays of anger and frustration, perhaps?
I think with us it's kind of earmarking a pressure or not frustration, but it's like a snapshot of a force, I guess.
So that makes a difference. It's in a way it's a sort of purer sort of activity, I think.
I guess in a way
that. What they seem to be very concerned with is what comes after. So, most of us, when we destroy something, it is about that moment of destruction. I think here the artists are more concerned with the moment after, and hence they leave these remnants. But the remnants are not nothing. They are actually something new.
Mm.
And we've been talking about how things collide, I don't know, even... you know, grand things, sublime things like galaxies and so on and so forth. And as bodies collide, debris is scattered everywhere and something else comes out of it. So I think that is also a very sculptural process when we tip sculpture into a space.
Right.
And I think this is really significant, and this is the moment at which the sculpture also becomes installational or installed. And of course, the sonic aspect very much factors into this, because the sonic aspect is something that cannot be contained by the space. The walls of the space struggle to contain the sound, and the sound is notoriously leaky and has a tendency of spilling everywhere. Mm. So we were doing sound checks today, and we were considering whether they should play outside or inside.
Okay.
But in fact, we decided it was going to be inside, because everybody seemed to love this idea of the sound bouncing around the space, but also leaking through the fissures in the space, under the doors, through the walls, through the next floor.
Would that be through volume? I mean, it would be very loud.
It's going to be loud.
Yeah.
It's quite bassy as well, isn't it? It's got quite a big scope, I guess. Yeah. So it
would resonate through.
It billows quite well.
But you've also created sort of limited edition. There was an object in a box. What was that? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, we made a few editions, and generally they've sort of coincided with a show that we've done.
Ah.
So there's a print that runs alongside the show of the symbols.
Right.
And we've sort of done different things where we've cast parts of drum kits that maybe...
Okay. I think we always feel like we then make an addition after a show because when you make installation...
Yeah.
After the show and you've taken the work away.
Right.
It's sort of another trace. It's another remnant of the shows that we've done.
So there is an edition of a complete plaster cymbal. Is it just the stand? I can't...
It's a sort of small piece that holds the tom above the kick
in the
drum.
Kick, yeah.
It's kind of an odd thing.
I think we liked it because it didn't have, to me or anyone who didn't know anything about drums, it wouldn't have a connotation of a drum. It just looked like a very odd piece of piping.
Right. Yes, I mean,
with a bone. it's the very first thing that sprang to mind when you were saying just now about the installation itself feeling kind of almost skeletal.
Mm.
And by placing this piece of piping in a box, in a black box, in a space particularly carved out for it, it feels like a votive bone.
Mm.
But doesn't it say in the description that it is soundproof foam around it?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like something that cannot make a sound or you cannot hear it. You've encapsulated something.
Yeah, you take all the sound potential away from it and it's just this solid object that doesn't make any noise at all.
Okay.
Because I think we are also interested in silence, and I think part of the show with the cymbals was trying to frame silence. It's sort of like the nothingness. When you look through this path, you are sort of aware of the wall that's in it, this empty wall.
Right.
So I think that's where a lot of these soundproofing.
The potential of silence.
And you mentioned the John Cage piece somewhere, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Some reference to that somewhere in the notes.
Yeah.
I can't remember quite where now.
Because what I think is interesting about that piece, the 4 minutes 33, you almost need the piano lid to be opened and then closed. It's this framing that I think is quite interesting, because otherwise you would just be listening in a room not knowing when it's going to start.
Right.
It's that lift, someone telling you it started and then suddenly you're aware of it.
Yeah. I think in the original performance, don't they lift it and close it twice during the performance, or is it just at the beginning and end? I can't quite remember.
There are always different versions of the thing. I mean, there is actually one version in which the thing is actually stopped by a phone ringing somewhere at the end of the hall. I think that with these momentous and enormous pieces, really important pieces, so there are invariably various versions of it.
Uh-huh.
But I think the issue of the frame is always a really interesting one, and I think that installation art and its relation to the room does, on the one hand, do away with the traditional form of framing, but actually it adds another way of thinking about a frame, because the frame actually becomes three-dimensional, nay, four-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, it adds the element of time. But whichever way one deals with it, I mean, this is a very personal thing. I mean, I profoundly believe that art is something that requires framing in some way, shape, or form. And it's something that I think all artists struggle with, because they must.
Mm.
And there's much written about this by the reader, which I will not go into.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Just to recap, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with Nico de Oliveira from the SE8 Gallery and Paul Good and Kirsty Wood, who... As artists, what name do you go by? Just that, Paul Good and Kirsty Wood?
Yeah, just our names.
Yeah.
Less is the band name, and we occasionally
the band
use it,
name is
not,
Less.
Yeah, but it's not so important.
And your show opens tonight, in fact.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Friday, September the 29th, and you will be playing live.
We will, at 7 o'clock.
Seven o'clock.
7 o'clock.
And it's not a private view, by invitation only. Anyone can turn up. Having said that you expect hundreds of people to flock to.
Please,
you better give
us
the address, Nico. Where is this place?
It's 171 Deptford High Street, SE8, 3NU.
Right.
And you'll be able to find the building, because it's right opposite the most beautiful Thomas Archer Church, a very rare building in Britain, one of only two that he built. But also, between the church and us is the most almighty hole in the road,
right,
which has been freshly dug as of the last 2 days.
Right. by
so look not for anything the right to words. Do with us.
Although, of course, at a certain point, it was interesting to note that the artists were smashing up resin in the back,
oh,
beautifully
really?
And okay. carefully,
right.
whilst the workmen in the streets had the most almighty digger uh-huh. working the road.
Right.
And for a moment we thought, shall we swap?
Yeah, I was going to say, could any thoughts of incorporating this into the performance?
Well, I kind of hope they've moved the digger now, which I'm sort of, I've embraced the digger. I kind of want to stay. It's quite good.
Shall we play another track from this album? Remind me of the name of the album again.
We are using your language to communicate.
Okay, and which track should we play?
Could we play We Were in Bloom?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, that was We Were in Bloom by the art duo, Paul Good and Kirsty Wood. Is that all right to call you an art duo?
Yeah, that's absolutely fine.
artist, musicians, yeah.
Yeah.
And do you work on it in the studio? I mean, to me, it sounds like there's been work done on it.
Two years' worth of work. Right.
We basically built a home recording
studio. Yeah, we built a home recording studio.
Oh, right. So you built your own studio.
And that's why it feels like a long process it is a long process from where we were to what we've, to that. I mean, it's obviously that's quite a complicated, big sound. But that's because we had kind of 2 to 3 years of just working on stuff at home.
Right.
And learning the software. And I suppose not, as I said before, not coming from a completely music background. It's right. Kind of making your own processes and finding, I think part of it, it sounds the way it does, is because we've had to learn how to use these programs and the layering that you can use that we would have never have been able to make something like that without that.
Right.
Technical.
I think also how in this process I think it's got much more gestural. I think that in the beginning it was much more we were trying to make music like we've always made music, and I think through this process we've realized with this technology how how gestural it can be and how you can really sculpt sound. I think that's what's for us really clicked, and that's why it's almost like taking sound and just throwing it. It's like you can really do that with technology, and that's what I think clicked for us.
Okay, and so to the, how long is this show on for, Nico?
The show's on for a month.
There's
plenty of time to go and visit.
Right.
If you don't come tonight.
And it's called Stale Air in a Room Before Motion. Any reason? What does the title relate to?
Stale air being, it's almost like something's about to happen, which I think probably ties into most of our work. Really, is this idea that it's stale air. It's something that's not. It's about to move. And as people enter the space, I guess they activate it. It becomes an active space.
Right.
And it's that moment before.
But it's stale air. Sounds like it's imbued with something not quite pleasant.
I also think it's not very nice. Yeah, no, you're right, because I think we thought the word stale first. That was kind of hanging around, like we've stale. Right. It's sort of like not a very nice word.
It became our new favourite word.
The word stale, it's sort of like not a very nice, especially for a show. People wouldn't. It's quite a sort of, like I say, some negative tone to it. Which
so
is,
it's not quite a vacuum, then. It's not nothingness. It's actually something there which is. Perhaps not entirely desirable.
Well, that's true, because stale would mean there's something in the air, there's bacteria.
But again, I suppose it's like a residue of something,
yeah.
As you were saying before about it's like the remnants, it's like something has happened there before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perhaps we don't want to know what. But another one of your statements here from these notes, the iconography employed in the work for Stale Air in a Room Before Motion recalls the emotional sublime present in works by romantic and symbolist paintings, such as David Friedrich's The Polar Sea and Arnold Buchland's The Island of the Dead, 1880. And it is the fusion of palpable human sentiment and overwhelming dread of the infinite that maintains their impact across the centuries.
Yes, I think that this is kind of a sentiment that underscores the exhibition in particular, and certainly I think that the question of the sublime is something which is very present at the moment. It disappeared for a long time precisely because of this underscoring of sentiment and indeed sentimentality. But I think...
What do you mean by underscoring?
Meaning that sentimentality is always present. A feeling is something which we see as kind of wholesome and important. But a sentiment tends to be something which is seen as much more negative. And of course the sublime painters...
But isn't sentiment is usually something that is kind of derided, isn't it, by fine artists?
Absolutely, but I think this is something which has come full circle again,
right.
Because I would say having spent quite a lot of time in the art world over the last 30 years, that, you know, even 10 years ago, you would not have been able to make certain kinds of work. But because of the digital generation, a lot of this iconography has actually returned. And in fact, we are looking at the Friedrichs and the Böcklins and, you know, the Gustave Moreaus, the symbolist painters, etc. We are re-examining all of this. And in a sense, I think we're living through a post-minimal moment. Mm-hmm. So all of these images are flooding our waking hours and, of course, also our subconscious.
Do you think there's a difference between sentiment and sentimental?
Oh, completely. Ah. I think sentiment is a very strong feeling, and sentimentality is when that very strong feeling tips just over the edge and becomes too much.
Right.
And I think that one might call it sugarcoating feelings.
Right.
But I think these sugarcoated feelings do exist very, very strongly in the digital sphere these days.
Right.
I mean, we only need to think about sharing pussycat photos on, you know, Instagram and what have you. Yeah. And I'm not saying that at all that this is entirely pejorative, but certainly this imagery has become once again part of popular culture, and a popular culture that's very much accessible to visual artists. Hence, for instance, the image of the falcons in the space.
Oh, right.
Which is perhaps something that Paul and Kirsty can tell us something about.
Yeah.
Well, this is when we used to live in a tower block in Bow called Balfour Tower. Kind of a famous architect made it.
Balfour Tower.
Balfour Tower. It's a brutalist. Is it Erno Goldfinger?
Right.
And that's actually where we made our album. We lived there for about 3 years. Oh. It was a live workspace. We had a big flat, and we made our album there. And we also, at the same time, there were a pair of peregrine falcons that lived on the top of the building that we never actually saw, but we knew people would always say there's these birds there.
Yeah.
And they live at the very top of this lift shaft. If you ever see the building, it's a sort of a separate lift shaft that goes all the way up the building. And then one time we're walking down the pathway towards the building, and we heard this big noise. We look up, and there's these two peregrine falcons just dive bombing all the way from the top, which is like 22 floors. Within a few seconds, we're just watching this, like, you know, amazed by it. And about 20 foot from the bottom, they separate and fly off in different directions. And we were just like, stood there like, God, that's such a good image.
Right.
So that's really where the birds came from. And that's
okay.
And then we started thinking about looking into why they do that. And it's over territory or mating, or these kind of different connotations, which are quite interesting. And then we started to think about what kind of landscape would these birds be in. And this is where this idea of a fractured landscape came from.
Right.
And that's where we led on to making the other sculpture, which is the broken resin piece.
Right. So what can we expect of this installation this evening, or is that giving too much away? Should we sort of just leave it as mysterious?
Well, I think that you can describe something like that. I don't think that's it's mysterious, because when you get there, it'll feel completely different anyway, because it'll be accompanied by sound, intermittent sound. It's lit very particularly with lights that make everything look like they're imbued with moonlight.
Uh-huh.
So it's very atmospheric. And in fact, when I was talking about this idea of the sublime and paintings that have a degree of sentiment and so on and so forth, and I guess that post-minimal moment, I think that there are some really interesting artists making very immersive spaces at the moment that are bodily immersive, but at the same time are also very strongly narrative. That is to say, they tell us a story. And the idea is that the public immerses themselves in the story. And it's not surprising that, you know, dare I mention things like Game of Thrones. I mean, people love Game of Thrones precisely because it gives that quality of immersivity. The fact that, yes, fine, it's a blockbuster and everybody knows about it, and some people think it's a bit cheesy, but the iconography of it is remarkably persistent, and it's not surprising that it's found its way in some way into the art world as well. The art world cannot simply say that we live in an entirely hermetic conceptual world. This is not the case.
Are you fans of Game of Thrones?
Unfortunately, yes.
You are.
But more actually Vikings.
Viking.
Yes.
I've never seen either of them.
I would say star, but there's
so
many.
No, don't. So that's hours of your life disappeared.
So just keep ignoring it, because you'll never stop.
Get hooked.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we could play another track.
Should we play Two Relics?
Two Relics, yeah.
Which is okay. A new one, which right. No one would have heard.
What's happening at the end? What is it? Sounds like a door slamming.
I was just thinking, have we got? Yeah, seem to like a slam, don't we?
Because well, we work from home, so you have things like door slamming.
Yeah. I think the other is it. Were You in Bloom has got me playing. I was playing the Radiators. So the running trackle through that is playing the Radiators with drumsticks.
Right. So just little simple things that like you hear in the background, and you think maybe that kind of works.
Yeah.
And it just adds a sort of, because it's so sort of. Just a good contrast at the end, just a big bang.
Right, yeah.
That's what
I'd say. Okay, we've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guests still are Paul Good and Kirsty Wood, whose band, can I call it a band? Less. You're called, as a duo, you play as Less. And the other guest is Nico de Oliveira, one half of Nico and Nikki.
Yes, Nicola Oxley.
Nicola Oxley.
Who I co-curate all the exhibitions with at SE8.
Right.
And in a variety of other places as well.
Yeah.
So
So tonight, Friday the 29th of September, what's the address again?
171 Deptford High Street, SE8 3NU.
Okay. There will be the opening of this show, Stale Air in a Room Before Motion, where Paul Good and Kirsty Wood will be playing live this evening during the event. Would you do you play throughout? The, I mean, are there musical events throughout the exhibition, or is it still a fixed installation?
Just tonight. There is a sound piece that plays over the show.
Right.
So when people visit, that's what they hear.
Right.
But for tonight, we're just doing something. It's a bit of an experiment, but we're just going to do a one-off.
Okay.
Because I think part of the reason for the trickiness of live performance is that a lot of the work is actually made in the studio. Using different programs and so on and so forth. So in a sense, what the artists are trying to do is replicate, wherever that's possible, a version of something that actually exists in a recorded format. And that's a rather wonderful reenactment.
Thank you all for coming in. We can play out with another track. This
Shadows.
One is Shadows from the album.
From our album that we released last year.
Okay, and will that be available at the gallery, Nico?
Yes, it will be.
Right, and plus this single, this new single, which is also part of the show, I think.
Yes, indeed.
That is actually, the single is a 45 RPM single, which is also called Stale Air in a Room Before Motion. Rushing down to the gallery from here?
We are, we're going to go straight there and rehearse for our performance.
Yeah?
Yes.
Our wavelength repeats now on Mondays twice at 3 a.m. and 3 p.m. So, not sure who listens at 3 a.m, but perhaps some people in America could tune in at that time.
Yes.
Who knows? Because Resonance goes worldwide on the internet.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.